All right, well, good afternoon. So glad to see you all. There's a sign-up sheet going around, so just make sure that you sign in before you leave. I'd like to introduce our speaker for this afternoon. Dr. Kreider teaches here in the English department at the university, and he will be talking to you guys about moving from monologue to dialogue in Litrad 2 essay. So let's welcome Dr. Kreider.
Thank you very much. Let me get started. I only have 45 minutes, which means I now have 42 minutes to explain to you how to master the research paper. And I thought I'd start by pointing out that the research paper takes different forms in different classes. And so the first thing I want to do is to caution you. And that is that whatever advice I give, whatever I tell you to do, or recommend that you do, you'll want to weigh that with the actual instructions you get from your instructor. So if I show you how to do something, but it isn't what they want, you might not be reading your rhetorical audience particularly well. So make sure that while you're working on your research papers, that you run this advice by your professor. I've actually entitled this, They Say X and Y, and I Say Z, as a way of paying homage to a book that I want to recommend called They Say, I Say. And it's sometimes very interesting. It's The Moves That Matter in Academic Writing. And one of the things that's so nice about the book, by the way, there are two versions of it. One is a long version with readings. I do not recommend. They're the kind of research paper you would do at a state university where the topics will be maybe less than compelling. The smaller version will give you everything that you need to have, including a lot of formulations of how to actually write particular kinds of sentences when you're engaging critical material. Anyway, I thought I should put that on the board so that I wouldn't be accused of plagiarism in my lecture, because I'm definitely borrowing from Graf and Berkenstein's book. And so the idea is to move you from monologue, right, where it's just you, mono, just you, writing about a text. It's a fantastic experience. There's nothing quite like it, where you sit down with the text in front of you, you have a question to answer or an idea to address, and you just get going. And there's nothing quite like the intellectual, imaginative, even spiritual intimacy that you have with a great book when you're doing that kind of writing. It's really quite wonderful. And I think most of us, your professors included, like to do that kind of writing. In my own work, for example, I always first just write about the text at hand. I just try to find out, what do I think about this text? Frankly, before I do any research, because I want to find out what I think, and then I go and I do research, and then I rethink what it is I thought before. So it's a community that really thrives, I think, on writing about individual texts, and we love the relationship that you have with the text at hand, and that's one form. But it's not the only form, and it's worth reminding ourselves at times that you actually come to the text after a lot of others have come to the text. So it's not just you and the text, but there's a whole community of people who are interested in the topics and the text that you're interested in. It's a really interesting phenomenon. Right, so you find this particular topic, you might be the only person in your Litrad section writing about it, about this text that we all love and admire, and then you realize there are others of you. You are not alone. That in fact, there's a whole community of people who are not only interested in the text, but they're actually interested in it from the very same point of view that you are, i.e. you find kindred spirits. You find kindred spirits who have already written. And this can be, in some sense, frustrating. I'm going to talk about that a little bit today. But it's extremely enabling. The reason it's frustrating is because when you move to dialogue, you realize you may not have been the first person to discover what it is you have discovered about the text. And it's a really frustrating experience. We've all had it. you discover something about the text, you're very excited, you're impressed with your own brilliance, you're like, woohoo, I've got a great idea. And then you read somebody and you think, oh, they had this idea 15 years ago, and it's frustrating. But what? Let me tell you why that's actually a good experience to have. Most of the writing that you do when you're the reading that you do when you're looking at secondary material for a research project is by established people. It's by people who have been at this for a very long time. So if you, as a freshman, or you as an undergraduate, encounter an argument that you discovered on your own in the secondary literature, that says a lot about you. That means that you actually discovered something really rather impressive. It just doesn't seem as impressive when you realize that it's not the first time it's been discovered. But the truth is more important than novelty. And so what you want to do is realize that although it can be frustrating, as soon as you engage that dialogue, something starts to happen to the work that you have already done that is very important and which we'll talk about today. Let me explain that then this is the first time, at least in Litrad, you may very well have written a research paper for your history course, but in Litrad, this is the first time you've had to engage other voices other than your own when writing about the text. So you're moving from monologue to dialogue, and instead of it just being you and the text, you find out that it's you right in a community of people addressing the text. And you have that experience, of course, in class itself when you come to class and your professor asks you a question, or in our sections when a student asks you a question, and you realize that everybody has different interpretations and you realize you're part of a community. So you already have that experience in class discussion, but this is a new experience because it's through the written form. It means you're joining a community of people that you don't know, or you only know them from their argument about the text at hand. And so what I want to do is I want to give you a way to think about this and through a metaphor, and that is to say, although I don't think it's a mere metaphor, and now that you've encountered Virgil in the Commedia, you'll understand what I mean. The text has other friends. There are other people that love your text. And that's very important to know, because there's a lot to learn from those who love your text. And so you want to get past frustration and toward discovery. Let me say a couple things about what I'm assuming in this presentation. Because again, there are various forms of the research paper. I'm assuming that you will have done an essay on Dante or on Milton, and that you're then annotating it. Some sections will call it the annotated essay. Others of us call it the research paper. But that you already have an argument. So for my Litred students, You have your Dante paper. Well, actually, I have your Dante papers because they're still not graded. Mea culpa. But when I return those, I'll have read you reading the text. And then you'll be doing research on Dante on that topic itself. So I'm assuming you actually already have an argument. I'm assuming that. You've written a paper. I'm also assuming, for the sake of this discussion, that you will have already completed your research. Now, a lot of you, no doubt, have not started your research. Relax, you're okay. But I'm going to assume, for the sake of this discussion, that you already have an argument, you already have a paper that you're revising based on research, and two, that the research is done. And so you'll want to take careful notes, because I suspect that some of this will make more sense once you've actually completed both of those things. But I want to show you what to do once you're actually done with your research. How to engage with the material that you will have already discovered, and how to engage it in a particular way. So the first thing to say is to ask what? When you're working on research, what are you doing? you're engaging secondary material. Let me talk about that a little bit.
So this is a simplification, but I think it holds true. So you have the text, and we call that a primary text. And then a lot of us will talk about criticism as secondary material, right? Text upon a text.
And in fact, the essay that you will have written is itself a piece of secondary material. You have just interpreted the text. So what you want to do is you want to engage it. You have this fantastic argument. And that argument, I'm just assuming that this is a fantastic paper, by the way. I should have said that. This paper that you're revising has just a wonderful, wonderful thesis. It's completely defended. Substantiated textually, conceptually, it's brilliant. It's artfully ordered, where you got a great opening, not conventional by any means. It proceeds in a very nice order. The reader knows where he or she is, concludes in a very fine way, maybe even inspirationally. Actually, UD students tend to be really good with conclusions. In fact, the last sentence of a UD essay is almost always really, really good. Now, that doesn't mean that every sentence that came before it is, but you almost all swing for a home run at the very end. It's really interesting. It's really interesting to see. And by the way, it is compelling. It's quite compelling. Sometimes it's the best sentence in the whole essay. At this moment where all of a sudden you really are attempting to persuade. And then, of course, that it's perfect at the sentence level, right? That all the words are precise and vivid, the sentences are just fashioned eloquently, everything's punctuated perfectly, it's been edited just to a T, it's even printed nicely. So I'm assuming that this thing is perfect, but it's still just you and your text. Now you need to engage other secondary material. This is where I'm just going to assume that you've done that. And those of you who have library tours will learn how to do that. Those of you who have already done your research under the guidance of your professor. But what I would say is, once you do that, once you have second items,
we'll just call them items. And of course, this raises the question of how many items? How many pieces of secondary material do I have to have? I always love that question, have to have. And then, of course, it's a negotiation.
So usually on the assignment it will say, you know, you must have between 3 to 5, 4 to 6, 6 to 8, 25, 50 to 75. No, we're not going to ask you to do that. But different people will ask you for a different number. So once you've done that, once you have done all of your research and you have encountered, let's say 5 to 8.
You have 5 to 8 items.
You would have more, but you've discovered they really weren't all that pertinent to what you're writing about. This is one of the advantages when you do research with an argument already in hand, is that it helps you sift out a lot of material you don't need to look at. And there's a lot. So if you're writing about Dante or Milton, you're not the first person to do so. There's going to be a massive amount of material, but a lot of it's not really going to be directly pertinent to what you're doing. And so you'll know that. You'll be able to see it right away. So for example, if you're writing on, let's say, one of the guides.
Let's say you're writing on Virgil and Dante, or Beatrice and Dante, or Bernard and Dante, my own favorite.
There's a whole literature on each one of those. So you're not going to read everything about the Commedia. You're going to be looking for those treatments of Virgil and the Commedia, Beatrice and the Commedia, Bernard, so on and so forth. So you come up with 5 to 8 choice items. Now at this point, you've read them, you know they're pertinent, but then the question is, what are you going to do with them? And this is where this talk comes in. This is really what I'm talking about. This is what you do with the research once you have it. And I'm going to give you something that's a little formulaic, and I apologize for that, and I don't expect that everybody will use this as a mere formula. But I think sometimes you need a formula. Some of you will wait too long to do your research. Some of you will wait too long to incorporate the research in your essay. Some of you will wait really too long. You have a lot of things to do late spring, I'm assuming. Am I right? Do you have a lot to do? All right, just checking. Good, you're getting your money's worth. You have a lot to do. I'm going to give you a way to do it that's going to strike some of you as a little formulaic. And what I would say is, it doesn't have to be used that way. You can start using it that way. You can use it that way in an emergency. They happen in an emergency. But they can also be used in a really subtle way. The first thing that you'll want to do is you're going to want to look for a pattern. So in all of these items, say you have five or six items, and let's just assume that each item is by an individual critic, and each one is addressing the same topic. And it turns out that there will always be a pattern. This is really intriguing to me, but there's always a pattern to the discussion. And let's say, for example, I'm making this up. Let's say you do Virgil and Dante, and you discover that there are really three schools. Or better yet, there are two schools, but then the second school has a lot of sub-schools. One school will say that Virgil is not necessary.
How could that be? He must be necessary.
Let's just assume that's the case. He's not a necessary guy.
But then you'll have a second school, and maybe that's two of these. But then you'll have another school which will say that Virgil is necessary. But then they'll break down to having, let's say, three different reasons. Virgil's necessary because of A,
because of B, because of C.
And so what you'll see is that these items will end up revealing a pattern to the discussion. You have to find it, then take it out, and then articulate it.
You say, where do I do that? Not yet. We're just talking about what you need to do.
What you need to do is you need to find a pattern of the discussion.
A pattern of the discussion.
Let's say you find 5 to 8 items on fault for the fall. You got your Adam people, you got your Eve people, you got your Satan people, you got your God people, you got your Raphael people, etc. And then you're going to say, there are the following camps, so to speak, or schools of interpretation. So that's what you're going to look for, that pattern. I think that's what's new here. I think most of you know how to drop secondary material into your essays. In fact, I have a hunch you've written a lot of bad research papers. And there's absolutely no insult meant here. I've written bad research papers. And you basically go quote hunting. There's a way to quote hunt in Litrad 1, you know, where you find a quotation that proves your point, you think, and then you drop it in. There's another way to do it with research. And that is, you've done all your research, and you more or less randomly just pick passages that you then wedge in wherever they appear topically pertinent. I don't think I'm the only one who's done this. Professor Spring up there is laughing with self-knowledge. You just wedge it in there. He's like, you want support from the secondary material? Here you go. You want a quote? You got a quote. That's the wrong way to do it, but we all, necessity occurs. There are emergencies. Instead, what you want to do is you want to look for that pattern. It's going to come out of the material itself. Let me make an observation about that. If your professor asks you for 5 to 8 items, and you're supplying 5 to 8 items, you know you have not read everything on the topic. There might be 12 books, 50 articles, all of that. But once you've done the research you're going to do, you want to act like this is all that exists. You want to be authoritative from what you've done. You are not an authority, but you should be authoritative. It's much more compelling to read authoritative student work. And so you're free to say, this is the discussion. There's going to be a little voice of conscience in the back of your mind that says, well, how do I know that's the discussion? I haven't read the 12 books and the 50 articles and all that. Don't worry about that. based on the work that you've done, be authoritative about saying, this is what the Dante community believes about Virgil and Dante. So the first thing you want to do is you want to find a pattern. Then you want to enter the discussion. So who are you? Where does your reading fit within that community of readings? Do you think he's necessary? Well, if you say yes, you're part of the second school. Do you think he's necessary because of reason A? Well, you're part of a sub-school of that school. Maybe, again, you think he's necessary because of B, and that's not actually anywhere in that discussion.
At which point you just contributed to the discussion.
You're now the distinct voice that that joins the discussion. So what you want to do is you want to discern the pattern of the discussion, and then you want to enter. You want to locate yourself within it, which is new. It's akin, for example, in class when you riff off someone else's comment. Not rip off, but riff off of somebody else's comment. Somebody says something and you say, oh, I agree with that, but that's the engagement. That's the moment. And so that is where you enter them. That's where you enter the discussion. That's what you need to do.
Well, where to put it?
Where to put it? There are three places. Again, this is somewhat formulaic, but I think that it's a helpful beginning. The first place to put or locate the secondary material is in a critical review section between the introduction and the proof. And I'm afraid, yes, this might mean going back into your essay, putting your bar where it needs to be, and hitting enter, 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 enter. And so you leave yourself a little bit of space, and then you have space for your critical review. And here what you do is you provide and demonstrate the pattern. And you say, there are two schools of interpretation of Virgil's necessity in the Aeneid. There are those who say that he's necessary and those who say that he isn't. Those who say that he's necessary for the following three reasons. A, B, C. Notice what's happening. At this point, you have actually located in your writing, you've located the pattern that you discovered in your reflection. And you have a space for it. And what's so helpful about this is you will have already, remember, your introduction is already very artfully done. You have your thesis, you've got an outline which might change because now you want to include your critical review. After a critical review of the scholarly discussion, allow me to X, Y, and Z, you drop that baby in there. Plunk. Plunk. This is often missing from even good work, undergraduate work. A lot of undergraduates do not do this. It's a shame. I think it's at least one full grade. All things remaining equal, a critical review paragraph's probably a full grade. Just a hunch. It's just a hunch. This is the kind of thing professors live for. You're all polite. You're not laughing out loud. No, really. Wow. You have mastered the discussion such that you can actually tell us what the pattern of it is. And what this does is this now locates in a general way your discussion, but it also gives you authority. It establishes your ethos. You are now somebody who has a right to make a case about the Commedia or Paradise Lost. Why? Because you have done your work. You have done your work. And you've done it in such a way that we're listening to you more carefully. The second way to do it is through individual engagements in the proof. Moments when you can return to somebody in the critical review, but take them up in greater detail. This is especially good if you can find somebody to disagree with. Because at that point, you might actually refute an argument about the text by refuting a critic. If you can't always, this doesn't always work this way, but when it does, it's really, really helpful. Because now you get to knock someone out. You basically get to establish your own case by refuting somebody else's. And you're now in, I probably shouldn't use such a violent metaphor for this, you get to engage someone else, which straight, no, no. I mean, sometimes it's just so-and-so's wrong. And you get to prove that they're wrong. And they're wrong because they disagree with you, which now makes you right. So you not only have authority, you have authority and you're right, which is good. It's very helpful. Your ethos is increasing quite a bit. This is going to be less formulaic, but let me give you four possibilities. Sometimes you'll agree and acknowledge. Agree and acknowledge. If somebody found it before you, just give it up to them. Just give it up to them. Sometimes you'll disagree and refute, which I was just talking about. But sometimes, and this is the best part, actually, and that is that you will qualify and relate. You will use your thesis to qualify theirs, or theirs to qualify yours, and you'll show yourself as dialogic, even dialectical in the Socratic sense. Now you're having an intense discussion with another critic, which refines the point that you've made. And this is really what elevates it, seems to me, out of the arena of the cut and paste job. Because now your thesis is probably going to change. Now you're going to need to rethink it and revise it. Not just play with it or edit it. You're going to need to actually revise. You're going to need to see it again. Third way, footnotes. Let me offer a caution. The world of the footnote is a wonderful world. It really is. Generally speaking, I would say that both freshmen and undergraduates, graduate students too, and professors, never mind. Footnotes are really difficult because nobody quite knows what they're for, in all honesty. There's a wonderful book by a fellow named Robert Gruden. It's just called Book. It's a murder mystery, but also an academic satire. And there's one scene in it in particular that I like. There's a literary critic who's working on an article, and his footnotes rebel. They actually rebel. At one point, one footnote says to another footnote, "Have you ever heard such bullshit?" And they start hiding. He can't find them in his text. And then they start showing up at inappropriate places, saying inappropriate things to him. Really, really wonderful. Now, on the one hand, that's a satire of bad academic writing. But there's always something mischievous and uncontrollable about footnotes. For one thing, once you learn how to write them, they're going to start multiplying. I mean, they're like rabbits. At a certain point, you won't be able to stop. I would say go easy on them right now, but let me give you one way that they're very helpful. Sometimes your review couldn't include something for whatever reason. Sometimes your individual engagements won't really allow you to include something, but you read it. You read that whole book. You read that whole article. You really want to put it in there. Why? Because you want your teacher to know that you read it. It's true, you know. I mean, and this is, footnotes are a great place for just subtle showing off, right? Where you say, look at what I read, I couldn't fit it anywhere, but if you would like to consider the following topic, see thus and so. And it shows even more breadth on your part. that you haven't included everything. You have left some things out by just dropping them into your footnotes. So this is what you're doing. This is where you're doing it. And if everybody could take out the sample essay, I thought we'd have a look at how you do it. This is an essay written by Christina Witkowski. It won the 2011 Raymond D. DiLorenzo Essay Contest Award. And it's on Milton. I could have picked one on Dante. In fact, if you go to the UD website
and just enter UD University Scholar,
you'll see that for four years, maybe five now, we have sample research papers. I would have a look at those, because each one of those is the best research paper that year. There are almost 400 freshmen. So this is the best of the 2011 season. So she writes, she's writing an essay on Milton's Satan. And let's have a look at her introduction. She says, Milton is notorious for inveighing against idolatry, the worship of physical objects in place of or over God. I love that definition of idolatry, by the way. Nice use of the topic of definition. A physical object need not be a golden calf or pillar of stone, however. Barbara Lewalski reveals that Milton insisted that anything could be made into an idol. He believed that the disposition to attach divinity or special sanctity to any person was idolatrous. Now notice, she's already included an individual engagement. Lewalski gave her, and by the way, I remember the process of this essay. She worked for my Lit. 2 as a class. And I remember that her conception of idolatry was a little thin when it was just her and Milton. But once she did her reading, she understood idolatry in a much richer sense. She had all these categories she didn't have before. And so what she's doing here is she's actually paying her debt. Lewalski's giving her an idea that she can then use right away. She's included it even in her introduction because it helps her with her thesis, which comes next. In Paradise Lost, Milton expands on the traditional definition of the sin to maintain that Satan commits idolatry through the adulation of his own person. Really interesting thesis. I think it's true, by the way, of Paradise Lost, and it's quite fresh. Satan commits idolatry through the adulation of his own person. Satan initially appears iconoclastic. So we have idolatry, we have self-idolatry, we also have iconoclasm, right? Iconoclastic in refusing to worship Milton's seemingly earthly and monarchic God. However, his attempt to usurp the role of the monarch, ludicrous efforts to imitate divine behavior, and denial of his ultimate inferiority to the divine nature indicate that the fallen angel truly embraces self-idolatry. So we get an introduction that has Milton plus the topic of idolatry, a refinement of it through the engagement of one piece of secondary material, a thesis, something you should recognize as an outline. You now know what the three parts of the essay are. She's going to take up his usurpation of the role of monarch, his imitation of divine behavior, and his denial of ultimate inferiority to divine nature. And then she repeats the thesis at the end of the intro. It's a very finely fashioned introduction, by the way. And then what you notice, next paragraph, critical review. Critical review. This is how it's done. Watch. This is a very fine essay. She's your age and your level of talent. There are several people in the room that I know quite well what the level of your talents are. So this is one of your own. This is not a professional piece of work. This is student work. In general, critics of Milton's Satan are divided into two camps in regard to the degree to which the fallen angel commits idolatry. So she's found critics interested in her text and also in her topic. And also in her topic. A small group, this must be group one, here's the pattern, of critics from the 19th century, containing most notably Percy Bysshe Shelley and Sir Walter Alexander Raleigh, maintained that Satan serves as an iconoclast as opposed to an idol. Citing the fallen angel's aversion for the oppressive monarchy of the father, the romantic critics asserted that Milton, a lifelong proponent of iconoclasm and the downfall of divine right monarchy, related to and sided with Satan's rebellion against the father's kingdom. Group one, camp one. Of the devil's party, but didn't know it, right? As Blake will put it. But then she says, a majority of critics, this is going to be camp two, a majority of critics, William Flesh, C.S. Lewis, Barbara Lewalski, and Stanley Fish, among others, believe that Satan, rather than exhibiting disgust for the servile adulation of a seemingly earthly monarch, embodies the qualities of an idolater in that he hypocritically attempts to assume the place of the Almighty he professes to abhor. So two camps, one minority camp, one majority camp. So now what she's done, by the way, her credibility, her authority is very, very strong at this point, I have to say. I mean, as a reader of this essay, I'm thinking, I trust her. Say, should you trust her? I don't know, but I do. Because she's managing a pretty complicated discussion of a difficult topic, and she spotted the pattern, so to speak. And you can tell, well, let me put it to you this way. Let me ask you a question. Sorry. Let me ask you a question. Which camp do you think she's in? Is she in camp one, the minority, or camp two, the majority? How many think she's in camp one? How many of you think she's in camp two? Yeah, she's in camp two. She never says so. She doesn't say so yet. It's just you know what her thesis is. And so as soon as you hit that second part, you already know. She doesn't have to say, I agree with camp two. She doesn't need to say that. You know that. But you're also prepared because what you notice, this is one of the things that makes, by the way, all the winners are great. But it's also a very difficult decision every year. I've been on the selection committee. First of all, it's difficult to choose the best essay out of a section of essays because there are always a number that are quite, quite good. Then you put all the great ones together and then you still have to sift. And there's a lot of talent in the freshman class every year. This year too. I mean, this is a particularly gifted group. I don't have to flatter you, I have tenure. It's just true. they can't fire me. But you guys are pretty impressive. There will be very fine essays, and this summer will be a very hard decision to make. She's doing a really good job. Not only do you know what camp she's in, but you also have a sense that she may contribute. Because when she went to review the critical positions, nowhere in there does she have a critic indicating that Satan turns himself into his own idol. That looks like a new position. Now, I won't have time to work through the whole essay. She's got a number of other very interesting individual engagements. I highly recommend it for your pleasure reading and your imitation. But what I would say is, let me give you a question to think about when you read this essay. Did she get this from someone else? Did she invent it? So did she get it from someone else? Did she invent it? Or did it arise in her engagement with someone else? Did it come out of research? And the reason that I'm asking that is because I want to address not just the question of what to do, where to do it, how to do it, but also why to do it. Let's say you read the essay and you conclude that Christina was able to fashion this thesis which is new, which nobody else had quite seen or put in this way before, but she was only able to do it by engaging the critical discussion. Here's the why.
And you have a right to ask that. You should always ask that. Right? You should,
why am I doing the educational things that I'm doing? Why are you here? I mean, I don't mean in this room. Why are you here? Why are you at UD? Why are you making the sacrifices that I know you're making, or that your parents are making, in order for you to have the 4 years of a UD education? Why? And then to ask that about the smaller things. Why am I doing a Lit-Tred 2 research paper? Because it's a sign. Okay. But why would we ask you to do it? Because what's so really interesting about it, and I've seen this having worked with so many students on it, first on an essay on Dante and on Milton, then people revisiting one of those essays and doing research, is that it elevates you. It refines you. You get worthy interlocutors. You get a new community to join. Beyond your teacher, beyond your peers, and beyond yourself, to work on an important idea about an important text. I mean, after all, Christina is writing about how Satan is misdisposed toward himself and toward God, which sounds pretty significant. As a topic in Paradise Lost, it's central. As a topic in life, it's central. Definitely. So don't think of this as what? Like filling out a tax form. Right? Don't think of it as a writing assignment as something I must do. Like, I'm sure.
I don't know. Any list makers in here? I tend to be a big list maker. Like, somewhere you have your Lit-Tred 2 research paper on a list. Things to do. And just think about how pleasurable it's going to be. Check that baby off, right? It's done.
Enjoy the check. Mark when you get to check it off. But don't think about it that way when you're doing it. Instead, think, what do I have to learn from these advanced readers of the text, and what do I have to teach them? Who are my new friends? Some of them, by the way, are dead. C.S. Lewis, oh, actually, quite a few of them. Shelley, dead. Raleigh, dead. Lewis is dead. I don't know about Flesch. Lewalski and Fisher still living. Point being that you're joining a community that has thought that, and on this I'll conclude. If you have questions, by the way, I will stay after, but this is designated as finishing at 3:45, so we will finish at 3:45, and you're free to go as soon as I conclude. But if you want to ask questions, I will stick around. If you ask yourself why am I engaged in this? You're engaged in this enterprise in order to challenge yourself intellectually, imaginatively, and even spiritually to improve your game. To be more in response to the great text than you are right now. And that's the why. Let me let you go because I'm now a minute over. Thank you very much. Good luck with your research papers.
Making friends with dead people.
Well, or we could say making friends with more dead people.
talking with dead people about dead people.
That's right, sometimes.
Dead people feel dead.
Well, you know, the nice thing about a good education is that you're no longer limited to the living.
And were they limited to the living?
Yeah, some of the best are already.
It's reassuring.
Well, I find it inspiring because it means that you have access.
They can't do anything more. To
go ahead.
They can't do anything more.